Hello everyone. Thanks for tuning into the Rain Matter podcast, where we speak to some of the best and brightest founders and investors from the startup world. My guest today is Ashutosh Dhathar, the co-founder of India Data Hub. It's a data and insights platform for economic and financial data. Ashutosh was an analyst at Morgan Stanley and an economist at IIFL, where he started India Data Hub as a passion project, which later turned into a full-fledged startup. India Data Hub also publishes a fascinating annual publication called the India Data Book, which gives you a sweeping overview of the Indian economy. It contains rich insights on demographics, agriculture, infrastructure, banking, capital markets, and much more. So I caught up with Ashutosh to talk about the events that led to the birth of India Data Hub and also discuss some of the highlights from the data book. I absolutely enjoyed chatting with Ashutosh, and I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation as much as I did recording it. Hey Ashutosh, thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bhuvan. It's lovely.
So, you know, we have the second half of the conversation is really interested, but let me start with the first half first and, you know, get to know you a little bit. So,
sure.
Let's start right at the start and then tell us how you ended up where you are today, a bit of your origin story, if you will.
All right. Okay. So, I mean, if I go really back, it's a series of accidents. It's one of my most favorite things that I hear is that Steve Jobs Stanford commencement address, and he says, "I'm just going to tell you three stories. That's it." And one of the most important stories that he tells me to my mind is that the dots always connect in hindsight. As sort of any sort of person. Growing up in the 80s, early 90s, your career essentially was you will study, you will go take science, you will study engineering, and you will end up with, let's say, because I come from Bombay, you will work with L&T or Reliance or something of that sort, or you get into software and you go abroad and work in some software job. It's strangely, some coincidences, I ended up taking commerce, I ended up taking accounting, ended up having a fascination for capital markets, ended up doing MBA, landed up first job with JP Morgan doing equity research, fascinated with it, ended up with IIFL, spent almost 11 years with them doing research. And sort of at some point of time, you say that, okay, I've done what I wanted to. I've sort of got bored a bit. I need something different in life. And so that's how sort of India Data Hub is started. And sort of that's why sort of I guess I'm here talking to you.
Got it. So what was the role exactly at IIFL? I'm guessing that's where you spent a good chunk of your career.
Yeah. So 2007 up until 2018, so about 11 years, I was sort of started typically as an associate to a lead analyst, then you become the lead analyst yourself. So I became the economist, did a bit of equity strategy, thematic research, largely macro stuff, which is what I used to do at JP Morgan as well. So sort of in a sense, I've throughout the equity research career largely done sort of macro research, thematic research. So that's what I've done for about 12, 13 years on the sell side.
Got it. Let me ask you an odd question about your time at IIFL. So what is the day in the life of an economist in an institutional desk look like? Like how boring to how interesting is it?
So it is, depending on how you see it, what happens typically is that you have two distinct or three distinct hats that you wear. So one is you are tracking the high frequency data, commenting on that, understanding what's happening with the economy, how that might impact with, let's say, interest rates or inflation or what, how that might impact corporate earnings, for example. So that's sort of the high frequency data monitoring of that and sort of interacting, sort of passing on that with the other research members who see a slightly different picture, who see more a bottom-up picture in terms of what the companies are telling them. So that's the sort of the one hat that you wear. The other hat is obviously client-facing. If you are a writing analyst or if you are a senior analyst, you are on the phone talking to people, meeting people, doing roadshows, traveling extensively and sort of communicating, in a sense, your views, your thoughts to clients. And the third hat is sort of the thematic research, which is where you try and sort of do a bit of crystal gazing and see, okay, 3 years out, 4 years out, 5 years out, what are the big trends that clients should be watching out for, or sort of analysts should be on top of it, and how that might impact, let's say, is the FMCG sector likely to see a bit of a change? Is it likely to see tailwinds? Is it likely to see headwinds? So sort of what's happening with the IT sector if the rupee is going to depreciate? Is that good news, bad news? So sort of slightly longer term crystal ball gazing. So that's sort of roughly the sort of the three hats that you wear.
Got it. So I think one interesting skill that you might need when you're, you know, pouring through all these data sources and all these data releases is like the skill to judge what's right and what's wrong. Like throughout your career, like how did that evolve, in the sense that, because there are 1,000 data releases in a given month, but how do you filter the noise and then, you know, get the signal?
I guess that's something that you sort of cultivate over a period of time, sort of which data is relevant, and within that, when is a particular data release of that data set sort of relevant? It's either signifying a change in trend, a change in trajectory, etc. So it's sort of largely judgmental that you develop. I mean, for example, inflation, for example, you will see inflation sort of going up. Newspapers will make a big story out of it. And then you look into data and you say it's sort of vegetable onion prices, which have gone. And you say, okay, onion prices sort of go through this very, very high oscillation. They might go to 100 rupees a kilo, or they might crash to 5 rupees a kilo. And you've been sort of every 2 or 3 years, we see that cycle. So there's nothing that as an economist or as an investor you should be worried about. You should sort of look through the data. So it's sort of a judgment that you develop for a period of time. But maybe it's something to do with rural wage growth or some other factor that you see structural. And then you say, hey, sort of inflation is going up, but it's going for factors that I probably think are durable or likely to go sustain. So you should take a note of it and evolve your thesis in the way you are either investing or borrowing or lending, etc. So it's sort of to extent judgment, to an extent depends on sort of granularity of data that you can access and sort of blend that both.
Got it. So you left the action-packed world of institutional research, and today you are the founder of India Data Hub. So tell us what India Data Hub is, and also more importantly, what was that the initial seed which sparked the idea of India Data Hub?
So I quit IIFL in 2018, and it was sort of happens when you've done something for 10, 11 years. So one of the problems sort of that happens in an equity research sort of career is that there is no growth per se. In a corporate sort of life, you might start, you learn hierarchies, you might become the VP, senior VP, MD, etc., etc. There are hierarchies, responsibilities that you take. So your role, in a sense, keeps on evolving. Whereas in an equity research, it's true for economists, it's true for any other sort of analyst, that you essentially are doing the same thing pretty much day in and day out. Some people like the kick that they get out of it, and some people over a period of time sort of get bored of it. And that's essentially what happened. And then sort of one fine day, I said, let's try and do something around data, because that's something that I've been doing for the past 12 years. That's probably something that I understand a bit better. So we started that as a hobby, I guess. India Data Hub essentially was a hobby. Let's see where it goes, sort of an idea in sort of early 2019 when we started. July, August 2020, when we sort of first had our first book, and somebody approached us and say, hey, can you license this for us? That's when it sort of hit us that maybe we can monetize it, and it's sort of no longer just a hobby project. That's when it sort of became a bit more serious as a business. It sort of evolved from just being a hobby where we were getting a kick out of doing what we were doing to now sort of where it's sort of slightly serious business venture that we're doing.
So what does the team look like today, and what are the backgrounds of the founding team?
I, as you know, come from the sell side institutional sort of background. My partner Pranoti, she comes with a tech background. She's worked with JP Morgan and Oracle and Infosys and all of that, largely on the technology domain. So she leads the technology side for us. I look at the data side for us. We have Jyoti and Anisha sort of who work with me on the data side, and there is a couple of people, Akshay and Zuli on the technology side. So we are sort of 6 people, a couple of interns, sort of 8-9 member team as of now.
Got it. So the first time I came across India Data was actually by a tweet from Professor Sanjay Bakshi. So I was looking for some data, and then it was a nightmare. So then I went to the website, and there was some public resources PDF that you guys had put out. And there was
if I remember that old version of the website was, there was a landing page full of open data points. So, and it made my life simpler at that point of time. And then I was wondering, you know, why doesn't something like this exist? So if you were to sort of step back and look at the competitive landscape, I know it sounds like a scary word, but like, who are you competing against and what does that landscape look like today? Because everybody says data, data, data. And it's almost become a meaningless buzzword.
So actually, we don't think in terms of competing against someone. What we're trying to do is something pretty different. So, I mean, if you look at it sort of slightly bigger picture, in terms of providing data, there are vendors out there who provide people with access to data. They're both domestic firms as well as large global platforms, including the likes of Bloomberg and Reuters and all of that. So you have pretty much the entire spectrum where access to data is concerned. Some of them do a decent job. Some of them are very expensive. So across different price points and across different use cases and all that. But what we're trying to do is something different. So we are not, in a sense, being a database company. I think that's something that we're trying to different. So data is sort of the raw material. And what we're trying to do is help people users understand that data, contextualize the data, and sort of make their life simple by saying, okay, these are not the things that you need to worry about. These are the things that you need to worry about. So in that sense, our role is not as a provider of data, but as somebody who curates data, contextualizes data, and visualize or presents that data in a manner that reduces the clutter and noise. I think the problem that I see over the last few years that I've interacted people is that people get put off by data because it becomes so complex. And I think what we're trying to do is to take that complexity out and say, okay, there might be 100,000 indicators out there that might exist, but that is not what you that is not what you need. These are just the 10 indicators, for example, that you need to track if you need to be on top of, let's say, banking, or if you want to be on top of telecom. That's essentially the role that we are providing, and sort of data, thus in a sense, becomes rather than input, rather than the output for us.
This will sound like a weird question, but like you mentioned, there's, you know, giants in the space, right, from everybody from, let's say, CMIE, S&P to your Bloombergs. And you also mentioned an interesting point in the sense that you guys aren't really a database company. And you guys are more synthesizing the data and presenting it in an actionable form or more digestible form. In a weird way, have you thought about why nobody has done this in the space in India? Because we are in 2022 today. And this is a pain point in the sense that any reason why none of these established giants haven't attempted to do this?
I think two or three reasons. One is that I don't think even they know if the market for what we are trying to do exists. For us, it's also an idea. So we're working with an hypothesis that a market exists for that, and we'll see and sort of we'll find out if the market really does exist. So they also don't know whether if they knew that a market really exists and a reasonably large market, they probably would have wanted to do that. That is A. B, I think they have the large corporate clients, in a sense, whom they sell bulky subscriptions. And if you make it piecemeal, then you sort of end up having sort of losing revenue on the sort of large corporate institution, because a large corporate might pay for a corporate subscription, which's only two people in the team who might be consuming that. And for them, a fraction of if it's you offer individual retail subscription, they might take for that. So your revenue, in a sense, you end up bit of cannibalizing your existing sort of revenue base. So I can think of sort of those two being sort of the reason why anybody's sort of people have not done it. And I think in a large sense, it is also a function of inertia. If you've done something a certain way for the last 10, 15, 20 years, some of these firms are like 30, 40 year old firms, and you have a standing in the market, you are large, then wanting to change something drastically is not easy. So your sort of whole processes, systems, everything is set up in a certain way, and there is no pressing need to change. Just the business continues. So then let the status quo continue, in a sense. So I guess these are the sort of reasons why nobody's tried what we are trying.
Right, makes sense. To your point about even you guys trying to validate this hypothesis as to whether there is a market for what you guys are doing. Mm-hmm. 2-3 years into what you guys are doing. Like, do you have a sense that there is, a large enough audience that will pay for the services and, the tools that you guys are building?
Yes, I think sort of so far we've been happy with the response that we've got. So I think as things stand now, I think there is reason to believe that the path that we are going on to is the right path. How big the market is we'll figure out. But I think the early signs, in a sense, it's like sort of an election day, 10 o'clock. You said early trends are encouraging. So it's sort of that.
Got it. On the same note, you know, there's that old Charlie Munger quote, always invert. So if you were to invert and potentially think, you know, what could potentially disrupt India? I know it's too early in the journey for the question of disruption.
Yeah.
But if you just flip the question, have you thought about what's that the next, you know, big idea that could potentially disrupt this whole data space, so to speak? Or the space that you guys play?
Sure. So I don't think we think in terms of disrupt, because when you use the word disrupting something, you sort of envisage that there is a large existing incumbent, which is sort of either sort of a sitting duck out there, and then an upstart comes in and takes it head on and sort of defeats us. We are too small for somebody to disrupt us, in a sense. I think if I were to give an example of, let's say, Amazon, which started in 1997, and you had an existing setup called the Borders or Walmart, etc., where you could go and buy books. Sort of the Amazon started with an hypothesis that the way you buy books currently, which is you go to a bookstore, you sample different titles, you maybe read the first few pages, and you bought a book. That's the setup that was in the mid-90s. But people would rather prefer to just order it online, and sort of that convenience is what people were after. And Amazon started, in a sense, with that hypothesis that there is a large enough market which craved for that convenience. And they were proved right. So, in a sense, what sort of we are doing is we're going with the hypothesis that there is a large enough market which will want to understand data, contextualize that data, somebody who presents the data, sort of analyzes data without it being clickbait, without it being something that is over the top, etc. And there is a large enough market. So, what can go wrong for us is that there isn't a large enough market, which could either be that people want ready-made investment ideas. For example, what we are not doing is in the business of investment advice. So there isn't a large enough market for that. There is probably a market, but we are too early. The market might be out there 5 years down the line. We might be a bit too early for that. So I think we, like every sort of startup, we're starting with a presumption that there is a need for what we are trying to do. And it may be that we are mistaken and there isn't a large enough audience. A lot enough market for what we are trying to do. So what if anything can go wrong, it's either that or be that there is a market but we couldn't execute it and somebody else comes along and does a far better job at executing it. So it's either that we got the market wrong or we couldn't execute it, rather than in terms of somebody sort of disrupting us. I think it's sort of too small for somebody to disrupt.
Got it. If you were to step back, and also I think, you know, people in fintech will really appreciate these questions because their entire life revolves around CSVs. I think internally, someone from a tech team says we are in the business of importing CSVs, and we are not really a fintech company, but we are a CSV importing company. And your life revolves around CSVs. Just at a big picture level. So how hard it is to collate all the data? I mean, you guys must be reading and parsing hundreds and thousands of sources. What is that, you know, that landscape look like? How bad is the data that you guys consume? What are the pain points that you guys deal with when you guys are cleaning up, sanitizing the data and making it presentable? How bad is it or how good is it?
It's getting better, actually. So sort of the glass is, as they say, perennially half full. So in a sense, you can look at the upside or you can look at the bad side. I think things have improved significantly in the last few years, but there are still significant challenges. The data is, I mean, as something as basic as that, there is no fixed date on which data gets released. For certain departments of the government, for example, we'll have a specific date, okay, 5:30 p.m. on the 12th, you will get the CPI data. If it's a holiday, it will be on the 13th. If it's a holiday, we'll get 14th. It's set line in stone. But that is, by and large, very, very far and few in between. By and large, most departments, the data gets released. The date is approximate. It's something that we sort of, so we have an economic calendar for our website. That data is largely based on our judgment as to when the data is likely to be released in most cases. So that sort of is sort of one of the problems. The other problem, for example, is that the reporting units differ across departments, and sometimes the same department will change. So RBI, up until a few years back, used to report data in billions and billions. One fine day, 3-4 years back, they just changed it. Overnight, data got released in crores and lakhs. And sort of the, everything that we had set up, everything went for a toss because we couldn't figure out what was happening. And when we dug into the sort of source data and find that, okay, the data is not in billions, in crores, and we were sort of wondering why everything is down 95% and 99%, the world is not coming to it. So it's sort of something as simple as that. And then you have some government departments still releasing data in millions, some in billions, some will still report scanned PDFs rather than sort of an Excel or a CSV. So you can think of it as being bad, but if I look at the last 10 or 15 years that I have worked with this, I think I can say that things were worse before and things are getting better. And if they continue to get better, it makes our life a lot easier.
Got it. Also, broadly speaking, I think there's this move towards open data, quote unquote, so to speak.
Yeah.
So be it unlocking data, it could be something as like open banking in the UK and also unlocking data that resides inside institutions, for example, the account aggregator framework. And also the government also, I think, is making some attempts with, I don't know when was the exact date, it was the data GOV portal where they tried to make this work cleaner. So is that move happening in the sense, and how does it change life for you guys in the sense that governments and institutions trying to make data more open and more cleaner?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a thrust and a determination on the part of the government to make this happen. And there are steps being taken in that direction. So we see a lot more data out there which we can access, which hitherto wasn't the case. So I'm quite optimistic that if I look at 5 years down the line, the landscape for data will change. And I think I'm sort of hoping that a stage comes when sort of the government will start releasing data in machine readable format, that we don't have to spend a lot of time and resources in cleaning and sanitizing the data, and we can sort of focus a lot of our energies on saying how do we make sense of that data and how do we sort of present that data in the most user-friendly format. So if we have to just focus on that, we'll be very happy if that were to happen. And sort of the more the data out there, in a sense, the more the opportunity for us, because there is so much more data that we can help make sense of. So I think sort of more data is always better for good for us. And if it is presented in a far more accessible manner, even that's also sort of helps us in being able to present that data and sort of make sense of that data.
Got it. So on that sense, let's assume that in an ideal world, everything is clean. There are no scanned images of PDFs and Excels, and then data is as clean as it could be. If in that ideal world, do you think then there is still a large enough market for somebody like you who's making sense of the data? Because I'm thinking of the recent inflation report that you guys put out, and it had a really quick snapshot of what happened, you know, what were the changes across categories, which I can't really for the life of me find it on some government website or RBA website and make sense of it quickly if I'm acting on something. In that ideal world, then does your role become more about synthesizing the data and ensuring there are actionable insights rather than just presentation?
Not really. So, in an ideal world that you describe, I think our focus will, so access to data will no longer be an edge, because the data is accessible to anyone easily. You don't have to struggle to find for data. So that does not. But the presenting of the data, the making sense of the data, that still remains a challenge, and that still remains an opportunity that, hey, we can help you make sense of the data better than somebody else. So that's essentially, in any sense, sort of, that's essentially what we are trying to do. We're not trying to say that we have data that is unique. The data is not unique. The data is out there. We're just presenting it or helping you trying to make sense of that data rather than saying that we have some proprietary data. The data that we use is not proprietary. What we are trying to do is saying we help you make sense of the data. We help you understand the data, and we can help you tell you, give you the context behind the data. Hey, last year this happened, and hence this year's data, we should be interpreting it with caution and not sort of jump the gun and say that, okay, all hunky dory or everything is bad and sort of that. So sort of that role of ours, in a sense, which we are trying to sort of pave, sort of still remains. It just makes our life easier because we have to worry less and spend less time and resources in the back end in getting that data, processing and data. That's the way I look at
it. Today, who uses your data? You guys are a B2B only company, and you, from whatever I've spoken to, you have no plans of either doing B2C in any immediate. So, in the immediate future. So today, who uses your data, and how do they use it? Just to get a broad sense of.
So the large sort of users will be the corporates, or sort of the businesses, in a sense, the analyst community, in a sense, the power users, as you'd call it, who need the Excel plugin, who need the sort of the data as and when it's released and stated. But we do have a subscription live, for example, for the analysis that we produce, not for the underlying data, which I suspect is not of much use to the ordinary layman to be able to access the sort of the tens of thousands of indicators, but the sort of the content or the analysis that we produce. We produce quite a bit of stuff every week, 3-4 times a week. So that is accessible through a B2C subscription. And the book, for example, part of that subscription can be purchased separately. But the entire platform, in a sense, which includes the API access, the Excel plugin, the dashboards, and all of it, is largely targeted at the B2B audience.
So if you were to step back and just take a broader view of the landscape today that you guys operate in, and if you were to think about any white spaces where there's a lot that could be done that could potentially help businesses, governments, analysts, etc., like, are there any white spaces that come to your mind?
Oh, so in terms of the data coverage, there is so much of stuff that we still have to do. I mean, we sort of barely scratched the surface in terms of covering the data. So we, for example, are building a district product, for example, which is we sort of collate all the district level data that we can, and you can, in a sense, understand at a very micro level sort of what's happening or sort of where different. So is Jaipur, for example, a more prosperous market, or is Jodhpur a more prosperous sort of region, for example? Sort of some of those questions, for example, can be answered better with a more granular data than, let's say, just the state level data. So that's sort of one of the spaces that we will get into sort of later this year. Corporate data, the whole scheme for corporate data, and then sort of doing analysis based on that is again something that we will be doing later this year. So those are just sort of two of the white spaces. And then there is the whole area of sort of alternate data, GIS, and all of that, which we haven't even talked about. So that sort of becomes sort of the third layer of data. So in terms of data, I think the problem is what do you want to do at a given point of time. Rather, there is too much to do and sort of too little bandwidth in that sense. So I don't think we will run out of ideas anytime soon. The question is whether you sort of focus on something that is worthy and then execute it, and then whether your hypothesis that there is a market out there for that comes through.
I mean, it's good that you mentioned alternate data, because it's been like this fancy term in the past, I don't know, maybe call it 7-8 years.
Yeah.
I'm thinking these hedge funds were using the satellite data, tracking the parking lots of Walmart tracking the heat density of the Indian, this thing, to figure out how the economy is doing, and then investing based on that. Do you think there is things to be done in making sense of this alternate data, so to speak, or is that largely hyped?
I think there is a bit of both. I think it's, to some extent, it's also a marketing plan. I mean, if I'm a hedge fund, if I give away an impression that I'm using cutting edge, as a hedge fund, I'm also, there's an AUM that I'm managing. So it's also, and I generate a fee based on a percentage of the AUM. So there is a bit of that also in terms of the way you want to position. But the alternate data, there is a huge wide spectrum. I mean, something like, for example, we track which sectors are seeing new companies being registered, or where are businesses being set up in India. And for example, last 2 or 3 years before this, last 4 or 5 years, we've seen chemical sector being very strong, chemical companies going up. And that was sort of consistently getting reflected quarter after quarter in new chemicals companies being formed. I mean, last 4 or 5 years, the number of new chemical companies being formed in India has gone up by 4 times. In a sense, that validates what you're seeing in the secondary market. Because if chemical companies are profitable, it's logical that you will see new chemical companies being set up. But equally, as an alternate sort of, if you think slightly ahead, you will say, if there are so many new entrants coming to the sector, maybe there aren't as many entry barriers in that sector. Maybe some of these companies will become big and eat into the profit, sort of the existing large profit pool. So this, in a sense, becomes a signal that can be a coincident indicator or a contingent indicator, depending on how do you assess the cycle to be playing out to be. So sort of GIS is sort of one manifestation of the alternate data, but something like this is the other way of looking at alternate data. This is something that very few people track, but this becomes a very, very, very useful sort of trend to track. All sort of people track commute these days, for example, and see sort of what's the urbanization, sort of urban demand trends, etc. So there are things that you can do, and there are things that you can sort of go overboard and say that I'm doing this. But But I think there is space, and as we sort of go along, there will be more opportunities to do something in that area. We sort of getting into it in India, sort of early days of doing that, sort of especially in China, things are at a far more advanced level, where people pay for sort of where people pay to track people's behavior in malls, for example, through Wi-Fi beacons and all of that. So sort of things are at a far advanced stage in some of those countries. So I think we'll sort of getting there, but there will be hype and there will be some genuine use cases as we go along.
Speaking of use cases, I mean, going back to the institutional days, like how was this data digested by, let's say, somebody like an analyst or somebody who's allocating money in funds, so on and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
Because again, going back to the earlier point, there's so much data. So because also this, you know, investing and trading based on macro data is also notoriously hard and not many people have managed to do it successfully also. So what's the art and science behind, you know, using this data to ensure that you are investing successfully? Like at a more philosophical level, if you will.
Sure. I don't think it's just about sort of macro data. It is also about asking whether the hypothesis that you, whether the data that is coming in is sort of fits into the hypothesis that you have. So let's say you might have an hypothesis, for example, that HDFC Bank is going to grow profits at 20% per year for the foreseeable future. And that would mean that, let's say their loans have to grow at 25%. Their deposits have to grow at, let's say, I don't know, 30%, CASA has to grow at, etc. So what the banking aggregate industry data will tell you is that if the banking industry is going to grow at just 5%, is it plausible for HDFC Bank to grow at 25%? It may be, it may not be, but that's sort of the hypothesis, sort of the question that you ask, whether if the industry is slowing down from 15% to 5%, does it change my hypothesis that I had for HDFC Bank or ICICI Bank or IndusInd Bank? And if it does, do I need to do something about it? And if it does, or maybe I don't need to do anything because the stock have already corrected, or maybe interest rates have gone down and that offsets the fundamental change because of the lower cost of capital. Or maybe I do need to do something, then what do I need to do? So it's A is about that I have a hypothesis or a framework in which my portfolio is built. And sort of every sort of set of data that I come by, I sort of ask myself, is this broadly in sync with my portfolio, or does it warrant me to change something in my portfolio? So let's say monsoons are going to be bad, and I have a very large exposure to consumer stocks. So do I need to do something about it? Or I'm a very long-term investor, I'm just going to ride it out. Or I think that some of these stocks are at a very frothy valuation and they could correct. And so I better trim down my overweight and sort of move into some other space for the time being. And if the stocks do correct, I can again go back to my overweight, build my overweight position back. So it's sort of also about sort of checking whether your hypothesis makes sense or nonsense, or whether you need to take any
action. So one of the reasons why I ask this is because there's a tendency, especially among the retail investors, to think, oh, GDP up, market up, inflation down, stocks bad, and this binary thinking is, it always gets people into trouble. So I just wanted to get your sensitivity.
Absolutely.
Got it.
Absolutely.
You know, taking a step back, so 2-3 years into building India data from being a hobby project, so to speak, to a serious business today, like what are some learnings that you guys have had, you know, in building this out?
I think in terms of learnings, it's been for example, I have learned some bits of technology which I never thought I could learn, for example. So sort of I have added I think vice versa. My sort of partner who has had nothing to do with economics has understood a bit of economic data. So at a sort of personal level, it's been. But I think the bigger picture is that the environment in which we operate in India has become so conducive for somebody to start a business. There is a support environment, whether it is funding, whether it is advice, whether it is simply going, finding a place to work with this whole co-working places. That in a sense, some of the risks that are typically associated with starting out and starting a business, I think some of the downside risks have to some extent being mitigated. And I think it's something that you knew as an economist at an abstract level, but when you are right in the middle of it and sort of be exposed to it as an entrepreneur, I think you experience it firsthand and sort of you realize the impact that it has. And equally, I think on the flip side, it sort of, you sort of realize that there is a lot of talk of, let's say, ease of doing business, but how far are we still off from sort of that idealistic environment in which compliance has become easier, or sort of it's easier to start a business or to do X or do Y. That while we have taken steps, but it's still a long way to go where it becomes very, very easy for somebody to start a, let's say, start a company, run a company, and sort of execute it. And so it's sort of being sort of it's been a very fascinating
year. Correct. So as an economist and also as a data analyst, you look at companies in the aggregate, for example. But on the flip side, as a founder, you are an input into the very data that you analyze. Does it wearing that hat of an economist help you in terms of making business decisions or anything related to building in a data hub? Has that been useful?
Yes and no. It's been yes to the extent that you sort of have a certain mindset with which you enter a business. I'm a student of Sanjay Bakshi, for example, from a very, very conservative sort of a background when it comes to investing, focus on cash flow, focus on some of those things. And you sort of apply that sort of trying business. So it's sort of whether that's a positive or negative, we'll find out. But you sort of are, in a sense, that sort of mold of thinking sort of building a business. So that's how it happens. It doesn't help in the sense that when somebody asks you, how are you doing? And you're the first of you, only 1% of the startups survive. So you said, the odds of my surviving are just 1%. So you start off with that statistic. And then somebody says, how can you survive with that mindset? But I said, well, I'm wearing a very different hat at this point of time. I hope I'm that 1%. But it cuts both ways.
Got it. That's interesting. And so one of the reasons I was really, really excited about having this conversation with you was this publication that you guys put out, this India Data Book, which gives you a bird's eye view of India. If I'm not wrong, this is the second edition, right?
Yes.
So I'm really curious, like, how did this idea about coming out, putting out this insanely complex and comprehensive and data-rich publication come about? Like, what was the thought process behind it?
Oh, the thought process for this was The Economist magazine publishes this pocket book, world book of statistics or something of that sort, which typically every alternate year I would go and purchase. It sort of cost, I think, £10 is what it would cost. It's sort of, most of the time it's available in India, but sometimes it's not, because you're all sort of traveling to the UK once in a while. Every year you go and pick it up from there. And I sort of always fascinated by that book. And sort of that's largely comes from background of being fascinated by numbers. So we thought, and there isn't something comparable of that sort in India. So we started off by wanting to do something of that sort for India. And they said, we're doing that, but why don't sort of add our own flavor to that? So we sort of added our own flavor through a lot of charts. This time we have some commentaries and all that. So sort of the product has evolved over the last couple of years. So sort of that's been the inspiration for us. It's sort of, if anybody from The Economist, it's a big thumbs up to what you
got it. For the listeners, the India Data Book is a really, really comprehensive state of the economy across your macro indicators, across demographics, industry, capital markets, so on and so forth. I'll include the link in the show notes so that you guys can go and purchase it. It's absolutely fascinating. But I just want to pick up a few things from the book, just to give sort of a limited teaser, if you will, to the listeners. Sort of right now, we are at a very interesting moment in history, like given whatever is happening in the last 2 years. There's that old quote that, there are decades that happen in decades or something that effect, and there are that old Stalin's quote, I'm guessing. So if you were to, look at from a lens of being an economist and also somebody who spent a lot of time poring over economic indicators in preparing this book, pre-COVID and post-COVID, how is the Indian economy doing today? Are we on the road to recovery, or are we in a bad spot? What does your economist perspective tell you?
I think the Indian economy, in a sense, has a habit of surprising people. I mean, one of the learnings that I have had over the last 15 years is that you should never get too optimistic or too pessimistic. So whenever you get too pessimistic about the economy, for example, a lot of people got in early 2020 when the pandemic first hit us, they were all surprised. And I think we've come out reasonably well from the pandemic. Most indicators seem to suggest that we are sort of at pre-COVID levels in terms of activity, if not higher. There is some bit of dispersion in activity in terms of the rural side of the economy still seems to be struggling a bit more compared to the urban side. But I suspect that is largely a function of lead and lag. There's a large migration of people that happened from urban to rural in 2020. Not everything has come back. So I think, and that's because you've seen first wave, then second wave, then a mini wave this year in Jan. I'm not sure people have the confidence that we are sort of done with this for sure and for good. And we can sort of go back and not have to worry about it coming back. So I guess some of these is transitional sort of friction, etc. But I'm optimistic that I think the economy is doing reasonably well. I think sort of the worry, if anything, is sort of what's happening globally, which feeds into India in terms of higher oil prices, higher commodity prices, inflation, RBI having to tighten rates, etc. These are largely cyclical. I think if you look at the next sort of 5-10 years out, I think there is every reason to be optimistic that the economy should be doing well over that time frame. There will be ups and downs, but I think on the whole, as Mr. Buffett says about America, you should never be bearish on America. I guess it's the same holds true. You should never be sort of long-term bearish on America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the performance of our market from 2000, I mean, we are clearly in the top quartile of in the global market.
Yeah.
So it has been a good
technique,
so to speak. There's also an interesting section on formalization of the Indian economy, broadly speaking, in the report also. Like, what do the numbers tell you?
So I think what was surprising to us, for example, was that through the pandemic, the pace of new firms being created in India didn't slacken at all. I mean, in FY21, which is April 2022, March 2021, which is sort of the first wave, the more firms got registered than in the prior year when there was no COVID. And in F21 to 22, which was when the second wave, a much more serious wave, even more number of companies that got set up. And I sort of as I read the Economist said, somebody will set up a firm only if he expects profits. It's with that expectation. It's not necessarily that they will get material, but it's an expectation. So if in the middle of the pandemic, when sort of your everything is declining, people are dying and all that, if entrepreneurs have the confidence that we can look through these passing few months, but we can look at the long 5-10 year picture, I think that is the biggest confidence that you can have on the economy, that people are putting their money in a sense and setting up new firms, and sort of that shows that your GDP might be declining, your industrial production might be declining, but people wouldn't set up a firm and incur the cost that it sort of comes along with it unless they were optimistic about the future and unless they expected profits and production and growth in the future. So I think the formalization trends over the last few years, it's been a conscious policy of the government to encourage formalization. We have something like 60 million informal businesses in the country and less than 2 million formal enterprises. That's a huge imbalance that we have currently. And you've seen the policy thrust and sort of some of that sort of playing out in terms of data. I think the number of new firms that are getting registered have doubled in the last few years. The number of active firms adjusted for number of firms that are closing down have also increased by more than 50%. So I think it's sort of as an economist, you want firms to get bigger because when they become bigger, they hire people, they invest in new capacity. So there is investment that happens and capacity. So you're seeing sort of in a sector some of that that happens. So sectors like manufacturing, for example, which is a part of sort of policy from the government, seeing significant increase in number of new firms. But also in health, for example, or education, agriculture, for example, which is a big surprise to us. That a sector which is as sort of riddled by friction and policy as agriculture is seeing sort of so many new corporate entities being set up. This could be for trading, this could be for new for commercial agriculture, etc. But that tells you that there is private capital flowing into something a sector which is as unproductive as you can get. I mean, that sector can really benefit from productivity boost. And if private capital is going through it, as somebody who's sort of believer of free markets, private capital going into a sector is always a positive. So I think there is lots of sort of longer term positive from this whole, from the whole process of formalization. Confidence in the economy, capital going into sectors which are either too unproductive or growing very fast. And I think that sets the stage in a sense for some sustained momentum with some cyclicality.
No, that's really interesting because this also speaks to the reason why you guys exist, because if somebody were to go and look at the pace of, you know, new company creation, it's very, very tough to get the data. You have no clue. For example, I was looking at this post the pandemic period, and the US data is really, really easy to come by. The trend mirrors there because new business starts have been at record highs. So I was interpreting that data in the Indian context and thinking it must be the same, but I have no clue. It was this is really, really amazing. And also there's a quite comprehensive section on capital markets in the report, which is our bread and butter. Big picture, like, what are the interesting trends that stand out in the capital markets, so to speak?
I think the big picture is that people are willing to put a far higher proportion of their savings into capital markets, which is sort of mutual funds as well as direct equity. So in a sense, that sort of suggests that the whole campaign by the mutual fund industry, mutual funds say, hey, encouraging systematic investment flow, etc. The work that firms like yourselves have done at making it easier for people to directly invest in equity. So all of that. So it's a combination of people willing to take on risk and also sort of the private sector sort of in a sense responding by creating awareness and making it easier for people to invest. I think far too long have we had a scenario where people would be content with fixed deposits sort of in a sense the risk capital we being reliant on foreign investors for providing that risk capital, but the domestic market now itself, I mean, last few months, for example, you've seen continuous outflows from foreign investors, but sort of in a sense the entire outselling being absorbed by the domestic investors, which is largely driven by the retail flows that are directly into equity or through mutual funds. So that sort of suggests that the domestic market is now getting mature enough to handle the volatility that comes along with sort of the economic ups and downs, global news flow, Fed tightening, etc. But is also an important counter buffer now to what the foreign portfolio investors might do. So we are not as vulnerable to their massive sort of their volatility in their flows. And also that there is now risk capital that domestic investors can make available to domestic companies for their growth. And that cuts across not just about secondary market, but equally primary market. I mean, we've seen a tremendous amount of funding for startups in the domestic market. So I think sort of the capital markets are sort of the economy is getting financialized in a sense, which is sort of the reliance on banking system in a sense is going down. And sort of the other mechanisms are going up, which is again is a very long-term positive. Sort of the only caveat is that if you sort of have a long enough cycle, a lot of the arguments that you see currently were made in 2007, 2008 before the global financial crisis. So touch wood. But sort of the crisis hit us and then it sort of took us 2008 to 2014 before investments, domestic liquidity recovered. So it's not the first time that we have analyst in 2008 made exactly the same arguments that the domestic investors are coming of age, domestic liquidity, and all of that. And then the Lehman Brothers went under one fine day, and then sort of the world changed. So these things the capital markets especially have very, very deep cycles, sort of very sharp and very deep cycles. So sort of, I mean, next month the picture could change, but I think the data so far is sort of very, very encouraging. Of the economy and the investors coming at large.
So one segment of the listeners a big segment of the listeners of this show will also be these people from the startup ecosystem broadly, so to speak. And for somebody who's also building in fintech, the ultimate sort of data point to look at essentially becomes, are there enough people with enough disposable incomes to save, invest, which will eventually feed back into their estimates about the market size, so on and so forth. But one worrying data point from the report was this decline in savings rate, household savings rate. We've had a secular increase from the 90s, but then from, call it 2015, there's been a steady decline in the savings rate. Like, what does your sense tell you as to why it is? Also, can an inference be made saying that the savings rate is decreasing at a time when household indebtedness is increasing? Is that a reasonable inference to me?
To some extent, I think the bigger driver there is so a large part of savings, household savings goes into real estate. And sort of the last 5 years when you've seen savings rate go down, it sort of coincides with the real estate industry being sort of struggling a bit. So it's sort of explained to a large extent by real estate as an asset not being attractive enough and hence money sort of not going into real estate. So I think sort of that is, so in a sense, it's a worry. It's a worry because especially for a lot of people in the capital market, look upon real estate, look down upon real estate as an investment. But the real estate, in a sense, or the construction industry, for example, is by large one of the biggest employers in the country. The labor intensity of that sector is more than manufacturing. So in a sense, when the real estate industry is sort of struggling, it's also sort of the job creation at slightly lower level that is also struggling. So in a sense, the real estate industry needs to come back, whether that means prices need to correct, inventories need to go down, etc. So sort of that's a separate discussion. But that the health of the real estate industry is important from an economic point of view because it is a large employer of slightly lower end of the social strata. So that real estate industry being struggling is sort of largely why people haven't invested in housing and people haven't invested in housing and its savings rate in a sense has going down. Financial savings, if you see during that period, especially in the last sort of 2015-16 onwards, there was a couple of years of blip, but again 2020-21 financial savings have been on upward. So I don't think it's a case, it's sort of something that we need to be worried about a lot. But I think it's something that we should think more from point of view of sort of the real estate industry being struggling. And the other drag, especially in the last 2 years, has been the government because tax revenues have been weak, so they've had to spend because of the pandemic, and their revenues have not made. So they've in a sense had higher deficits than what they had in, let's say, 2019 or 2018.
Got it.
So
there isn't a specific section on startups in the report, but broadly speaking, if you were to infer, the data point, make inferences from the data in the report. So one was this pace of new company creation, which, as you said, is really, really heartening. The second thing was, domestic financial flows more than making up for the foreign outflows. Like, are there any other data points that give you a sense of how the Indian startup ecosystem is doing, in terms of entrepreneurship, so on and so forth?
So the other sort of data that we have is, for example, on factories, we've seen increase in number of factories in the country, and that sort of links up to the manufacturing sector. There is a thrust through the PLI scheme on Make in India and so on. So in a sense, you've seen investments in manufacturing sector that reflects in fact number of factories increasing as well as new firms in manufacturing increasing. So sort of the two data points that point towards the same direction. If you look at electronic exports, for example, so they've increased for many fold, and that is largely again a function of not a startup in a classical right. sense, but investments that are happening in the electronic sector, which is hitherto basically next to zero in India. So sort of that sector coming into life. And sort of typically when you see a sector which is non-existent starting to become big, you will see a lot of ancillary sort of companies that will sort of blow. I mean, if you look at Gurgaon, for example, sort of Maruti went there one day and then the entire hub came about because of Maruti, the whole ancillary sector. So I think sort of once you have a certain minimum threshold of large sort of firms, you will see the whole ecosystem sort of develop around it, which will open up again a lot of opportunities for firms to feed into, in a sense, that hive and grow and make.
Got it. If to tie it all up, so the other thing that broadly affects everything that you have mentioned in the report is also sort of the policy stance of the government. It could be anybody. If you were to take a big picture view in terms of how the policies have fared in the last, call it a decade, and also slightly taking a step back and looking from the time we recovered from the 2008 crisis, because India wasn't really too deeply impacted by the crisis because we weren't really integrated into the global financial system. So if you were to take a look from, call it 2008, and till 2022, how do you make sense of the policy landscape in terms of whatever we have done to increase savings, entrepreneurship, so on and so forth? And also, like, if you had the power to change anything in a given day, what would you change?
Oh, the second question is actually very easy. I'll have a minister, a new cabinet minister, whose job is to cut down other ministers. it's absolutely clear. I mean, we need somebody who's just going to cut, make a lot of jobs irrelevant in the bureaucracy. So I think so that's the sort of the easiest question. I think if you sort of step back, we panicked a bit in 2008 when the global financial crisis hit. And as you said, we weren't as integrated into the world system then as we are now. The financial sector was. The financial sector got disproportionately impacted. But the real India, in a sense, wasn't as impacted. But we responded to a huge fiscal stimulus. And that, in a sense, sort of escalated into sort of the 2013 sort of the taper tantrum crisis, as we call it, and sort of the currency fell by 20%. We had a 5% current account deficit, and then we had to overnight raise interest rates when Rajan came in and so on. But if you sort of look at it from post thereafter, the last couple of years of the UPA government, when they had a tight rein on fiscal deficit and the sort of the rein so far, it's been sort of the consistent policy to liberalize, to cut taxes. So the corporate tax rate in India has sort of gone down. The tax system has got simplified. We moved to a GST, which is a far efficient tax system than the earlier sort of various different taxes at the center and state level. Sort of the whole thrust on Make in India and ease of doing business. So all of these are sort of steps in the right direction. The only complaint if I had was that we're not moving fast enough on several of these factors. So there is a lot more to be done on some of these things than we've achieved so far. And as somebody who's sort of set up a company, as running a company, something as simple as set up a company, sort of I can see that, okay, it's now become easier, but there's so much more that we've done to make it simple, to just simple register a company. So I think there is a lot of things that you can do to make it easier. I mean, as somebody who believes in free markets, wealth in an economy is created when two people transact. Because they do transact because it is both of them find value in making that transaction. And sort of the more the transactions that happen in the economy, the more the wealth that gets created. And the more that sort of wealth that creates, the more then you can decide how to distribute that wealth. You can then have taxes that distribute it. Then you can have a basic income. You can have a PDS. So all of that can be funded if you have that. But the sort of the premise has to be that there has to be a lot more transactions that happen between two willing private sector, private entities or individuals. I think if you sort of focus on that, and sort of make it easier to do business either within India, between India and outside, I think we'll sort of achieve that goal of getting to 8 to 10% GDP.
The final thing I want to pick your brains on is this in-moment topic of inflation and central banking. Because mostly investors and the market watchers tend to worry about it, but I think because some of the founders and startups will also be listening to it. It also affects them because inflation is a regressive tax which kind of eats into the discretionary spending of people, which means inevitably, indirectly, they will also be affected. So if you were to look at how our central banks have reacted, how our governments have reacted, and also just to take a step back, this isn't really our inflationary pressures. We are also importing a lot of this inflation due to supply chains and, you know, all this fiscal spending in the US and other advanced economies. But broadly speaking, how do you grade our central banks and our policymakers in the response towards inflation? And also from the last, let's say, 3-4 data releases, it kind of seems like we might be moderating. Like, what's your sense in terms of where we are headed?
Yeah, I think the data as it stands now does suggest that we might be at the peak and things might be moderating, so on. But sort of we've seen, I mean, for example, the supply chain shortages was first talked about in 2020, was supposed to be transitory then. Then in 2021, it was supposed to be transitory, and now we're sort of in 2022, and we're still saying that it's transitory. So yes, I mean, so the data is encouraging, but fingers crossed, so to say. But I think sort of it's clear to me that central banks across the world have been too slow to react. I think it's sort of the one thing that we need is low and stable inflation. That's sort of at the heart of from a monetary perspective, from the currency perspective, and from financial stability perspective. If you have low and stable inflation, then everything else follows. You can keep interest rates low. You don't need to make an abrupt change in interest rates that will take businesses by shock. You don't impact the poor, for example, who are disproportionately impacted by higher inflation. And so on. So I think it is imperative for every central bank to ensure that they stick with their mandate of low and stable inflation. And sort of across the globe, I think there's hardly any central bank which has managed to stick to that mandate. So in a sense, it's been disappointing that they've been caught napping with this
front. Got it. Thank you so much. That was my final question. It's been a brilliant, you know, learning experience for me. I'm pretty sure the people who are listening to will also have plenty of takeaways. So thank you for taking the time and doing this. I really, really appreciate this.
Thank you, Fabi. It was a pleasure speaking with you.